Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the, I think, fourth in the series of Cold War Studies Center's lecture for this year. My name is Chris Brown, and I'm convener of the International Relations Department. It's my privilege to chair this evening's discussion. It's my privilege because we have this evening with us the authors of two of the most interesting books on the neoconservatives and American foreign policy to come out in the last two or three years. Our first speaker is going to be Dr. Stefan Halper, fellow of Magdalen College, Cambridge, senior fellow of the Center of International Studies in Cambridge, who's co-author of a book called America Alone, The Neoconservatives and the Global Order, which I think in many people see as one of the best of the kind of historical studies of foreign policy over the last few years. Traces the growth of the neocons and their influence and possibly their declining influence. Stefan is has had a career as an academic, a journalist, a radio and TV broadcaster, and he has published on Latin America and other activities as well as his book. The second speaker today is Professor Anne Norton of the University of Pennsylvania. Anne is, I think, a very prolific author as well. She's written on numerous subjects. She's Professor of Political Science and Comparative Literature, which is a combination I like very much, and we should do more at the LSE. She's published on political identity, on liberal theory. Most recently, she's published a book on Leo Strauss and the politics of American empire, which is, I think, if I may say so, an absolutely delightful book. It's a book that combines a very sensitive reading of Leo Strauss and, in some respects, saving Leo Strauss from some of his disciples. You don't just learn a lot about American foreign policy. You learn a lot about the American academic culture of political theory. I learned, for example, that Leo Strauss referred to his PhD students as his puppies and used to send them to collect his laundry. I mentioned this to my own PhD students, and I have to say that their reaction wasn't wholly positive, I think it would be reasonable to say. Anne is, as I said, professor at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also a graduate of Chicago University, so has at least some kind of genealogical connections with Leo Strauss and the Straussians in that way. Now, our two speakers will speak for, I think, approximately 20 minutes each. In the order I've just announced them. We'll then be open for debate. I hope we'll confront each other, and they'll confront you, you'll confront them, and we'll have a general discussion on the subject. So I'd like to start off by introducing Dr. Stefan Halper. Stefan.
Well, thanks very much. It's very nice to be here. I want to thank Chris Brown, the chair, and also Mick Cox, who was instrumental in arranging this, and of course Ann Norton. Mick Cox has asked that I comment on where the neoconservative ideas came from, what their impact was on the United States, both at home and abroad, and whether the neoconservative moment is over. And I'd like to do this reasonably quickly so that we can get on with questions. But in the course of my comment, I'd like to place these questions in today's context. Allow me to begin by saying that the decision to go to war in Iraq, together with its constantly shifting rationale, constitutes the most damaging set of foreign policy decisions in my adult lifetime. And I've served in four Republican administrations in the White House and the State Department. I must say that this is a truly unique set of decisions. But it is more than anything else the latest expression of American exceptionalism. And I say this for a number of reasons, and I'll come to them. Of course, we wouldn't be talking about neoconservatives this evening had the nation not been hit by a catastrophic assault on September 11th. The administration responded by adopting a plan to remake the Middle East by replacing the regimes in Afghanistan and Iraq and using that platform to advance democracy in the region. In theory, the authoritarian regimes would be replaced by democratic ones and thus bring stability. Human rights and civil liberties would be improved, energy reserves would be secured for the West, and Israeli security would be reinforce going forward. Importantly, what had been a regional breeding ground for terrorism would be eliminated. As the neoconservatives say, we would have drained the swamp. This vision of America bringing good government and delivering order to others is rooted in the nation's belief that its exceptional moral clarity and the higher purpose that it has must be provided to others. This syndrome is as old as the nation itself. The drive to do this is especially apparent in times of heightened tensions or crisis. Many have described the neocons as muscular Wilsonians or evangelical Democrats, which they may be. But more than anything else, they are simply the most recent in a long line of American exceptionalists. And I'll return to this theme of American exceptionalism in just a moment. Mick Cox asks where the neocons came from. How did Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, Elliot Cohen, Doug Feith, and Scooter Libby arrive in positions of power in Washington? Some who've tried to define them concede that neoconservatives have no common manifesto, credo, religion, flag, anthem, or secret handshake. Nevertheless, they are people who changed the American political landscape. So who are they? The first generation of what we now call neocons appeared as socialists in the 1930s. They occupied Alcove One in New York University cafeteria and were known for spirited disputes with the Trotskyites in Alcove Two. Over the next three decades, they emerged as a significant philosophical presence in U.S. intellectual circles. Whereas the critic Lionel Trilling once described American conservative thought as, quote, irritable mental gestures which seek to resemble ideas, end quote. There's no doubt that the early neoconservatives helped to establish a genuinely American brand of conservatism that broke free of its European roots. Among them were some of the intellectual luminaries of the 20th century: Daniel Patrick Moynihan, Irving Kristol, Norman Podhoretz, Michael Novak, Daniel Bell. Within their discourse were debates on whether man suffered from spiritual chaos rather than an amalgam of institutional failures, whether one could understand the social conditions of the modern West while ignoring the central place of religion in past societies, how to achieve a successful balance between social control and individual freedom. They were an eclectic intellectual movement. Irving Kristol, for example, records on his graduation day in 1940. He was a member of the Young People's Socialist League, which was the Fourth International, and was at the same time reading the King James Bible and coming under the influence of Reinhold Niebuhr. Wide-ranging, they inquired into metaphysics, social welfare, Keynes, and many other things. They asked as many questions as they offered answers. The term neoconservative originally was a biographical as much as an ideological description. Although he didn't invent the term, Michael Harrington, who was the editor of Dissent, first used the term as a derogatory moniker for former comrades. It entered the modern American lexicon in the 1970s to describe a new breed of political animal who had turned towards the right as a former liberal disenchanted with the left's reluctance to stand up to the Soviets and to anti-American radicals. With Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman Scoop Jackson leading the way, and the Vietnam War as a backdrop, neoconservatives specifically rejected the notion that American actions in Vietnam were evil, and instead saw the conflict as a principled stand in support of democratic freedoms and self-determination of a small nation. Following the Cold War, neoconservatives rose to policy positions, ironically, just as their range of intellectual interests diminished. America's current expression of neoconservatism is intellectually dwarfed by the shadow of its progenitor. It is assertively binary in formulation, us versus them, good versus evil, Hobbes versus Kant, left versus right, and so on. Contrary to early neocons, who at the end of the Cold War said, mission accomplished, today's neocons focus heavily on foreign affairs, and even there they focus narrowly on the Middle East. Of course, today, few rush forward, burnishing the neoconservative banner to celebrate the wisdom of their policy in Iraq. We are seeing in just the last few weeks, with polls turning sharply negative on the Iraq war and exit strategies openly discussed by military commanders, there's a turning point in Iraq policy. The hard reality of the battle space, the unyielding casualty counts, budgetary reality, a restive Congress, and by the way, a dyspeptic vice president, and the unsympathetic prospects for the midterm elections in 2006 suggest to me that Washington has begun to separate itself from the latest expression of American exceptionalism. So in answer to Mick Cox's first question, that provides a bit of background on the neoconservatives. Now, permit me to change venues for just a moment. I'd like to approach American exceptionalism from another direction and say a few words on why neoconservative ideas like freedom on the march were accepted so readily by the Bush administration. The lure of big ideas in American politics, and exceptionalism in particular, is as old as the Republic itself. The young nation was animated by the notion that it was exceptional in its foundation in moral and in divine providence and its anointment to a higher purpose. John Winthrop's City on a Hill speech of 1630 still resonates as a defining image of American exceptionalism. Since that time, such pithy notions have often provided cohesion, identity, and direction to the nation. These big ideas running through the American discourse have often have strong spiritual or religious roots. Let me give you some examples of ideas that have animated the nation at various important points. Redeemer Nation, New Jerusalem, Manifest Destiny, Last Best Hope on Earth, Imperialism of Righteousness. That was the phrase in the turn of the 20th century when the country was moving to war against Spain. New Frontier. They all emphasize the idea that America is both special and separate with its own version of the rules. And as it is now today, November 22nd, allow me to remind you of John F. Kennedy's inaugural words. He said, "Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and success of liberty." America is fundamentally different from its European ancestor nations. It's a very separate nation, rooted in this higher providential purpose. It's not easy to imagine any European leader describing his country as President Bush did, for example, in January 2005, as having, quote, a calling beyond the stars, end quote. It's especially difficult to imagine a modern European nation fashioning a foreign policy around such a notion. Yet direction-setting metaphors or signposts illuminating American exceptionalism have contemporary expression in the context of the nation's Middle East effort. Neoconservatives advance their policy with the phrase freedom on the march and describe the enemy in religious terms as the axis of evil, putting America in the role of St. George. Of course, I mean the dragon slayer. And these are not isolated examples. Since 9/11, much of America's foreign policy has been justified in religious terms, which gave expression to both the idea of American exceptionalism and neoconservative purpose. Consider this line from President Bush's 2003 State of the Union address given on the eve of the Iraq War. Quote, "Freedom is not America's gift to the world, it is God's gift to humanity," end quote. My point in this is very simple. Neoconservatives did not simply arrive with a simple definition of the problem and a simple solution. They arrived on the back of a crisis that challenged America's role in the world, but even more, the legitimacy of American values. American exceptionalism was both challenged and mobilized, and the neocons rode that train. By the way, this is not the first time manifestations of American exceptionalism had brought miscalculation and dysfunctional policy. Allow me to bring you back to McCarthy and Henry Luce, who believed that America had a moral responsibility to mobilize democratic and Christian values to fight communism. The morally based American position eventuated in the belief that communism was monolithic and brought the conclusion that both the Korean and Vietnam Wars were directed from Moscow and Beijing. The effect was to fundamentally misunderstand the roots of the Korean War and to keep recognition of communist China off the agenda for decades. American exceptionalism is a continuing element in the American political culture. It is not until the nation is challenged or feels itself to be in crisis that this element rises to become a decisive factor. George Kennan, whom I'm sure most of you know, a legendary American diplomat, had this to say about, quote, embattled democracy. Quote, "There is nothing more egocentrical than the embattled democracy. When a society comes to believe it's embattled," he argued, "it will attach to its own cause an absolute value that distorts its vision of all else. Important questions are left unasked, unchecked assumptions harden into common knowledge, and the contest in which the society believes itself engaged assumes a final apocalyptic quality." Just as this was the situation confronting America in the late 40s and early 50s, as the Soviets marched across Eastern Europe and Mao secured the Chinese mainland, this was, I would suggest, the situation also following 9/11. Both were met with a surge of patriotism rooted in American exceptionalism. Following 9/11, the neoconservatives were able to ride a similar surge of patriotism, becoming the latest exponents of the exceptionalist phenomenon. Now, let me briefly turn to the last bit. The effects of the neocons have had on the United States and whether their moment has passed. Let me begin with the effects. The most disappointing aspect of the neoconservative ascendancy was the failure of key institutions. We saw important institutions of the rational center fail. Neither the mainstream media, like the New York Times, or the Washington Post, or the think tanks like CSIS, Heritage, or even Brookings, and certainly not the senators and representatives sitting in Congress in the winter and spring of 2003, asked the hard questions about the government's rationale for war and how the peace could be secured. In that respect, the institutions on which we rely for guidance on what good policy ought to look like failed us. The format for the debate, the television and radio shows and roundtables, discussions, found the media environment infused with the powerful patriotic dimension, which had the effect of suppressing debate, not illuminating alternatives. On America's most popular cable network, Fox, which I'm sure many of you watch, Bill O'Reilly and Hannity and Combs had little time for area experts and language speakers. Such experts, thought boring and pedantic, were marginalized. Much time was given to administration supporters, think tankers, and a coterie of journalists, from the Wall Street Journal editorial page, the Weekly Standard, National Review, and Fox itself, all interviewing each other to form an echo chamber with the White House press room. You might ask if this is a new phenomenon. It is not. The Rational Center and its institutions failed equally, or dramatically, let me say, in the run-up to the Vietnam War. In domestic political terms, Mr. Bush's second term has been crushed under the weight of a failed Iraq policy. Neocons are nowhere to be found these days. Mr. Wolfowitz, now the president of the World Bank, says, for example, Iraq doesn't come up much anymore. Strikes me as leaving the scene of an accident. President's approval ratings, now at 37%, mean that Republicans in Congress must be very wary. In swing districts, they must distance themselves from the White House, as Pennsylvania Senator Republican Rick Santorum did on a recent Bush trip to his state. More to the point, the president's budget, his energy legislation, his Social Security reform, which has to be the flagship legislation of his second term, have all fallen by the wayside. Crises like Katrina or House Majority Leader Tom DeLay's indictment or Senate Leader Bill Frist's legal troubles, which he might have weathered, other things being equal, have had a strong negative effect on the president's approval ratings. Nor should we forget that Scooter Libby's indictment stemmed from an investigation rooted in the administration claims about Saddam's Iraq. So if I can put it another way, were I George Bush, I would be very happy never to have heard of Paul Wolfowitz or Richard Pearl. Now, turning to the international side. By the way, you've got to remember that being at 37% say, approval rating is not unheard of. Lyndon Johnson was at 42% in April of 1968 when he announced he wouldn't run again. Harry Truman was at 22% when he approached the 1948 elections, which he actually won. So this is not unprecedented. It's just rather serious for him. On the international side, with reference to American empire, which I should say a word about, the neoconservative-inspired revolution in military affairs affords the U.S. with remarkable achievements on the battlefield. Guided munitions mean insurgents in a fourth-floor office suite in Ramallah can be extinguished while the rest of the building remains largely undamaged. Problem is that the revolution in military affairs, the RMA, is not suited to winning today's wars. The challenge has moved on. It is how to manage the peace or achieve peace on acceptable terms, and that is a technology neither Washington nor anyone else possesses. And it is a process the neocon Manichaean vision is uniquely unsuitable to address. So where have the neocons left us? Striking to me is a new poll, the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press, which I'm sure many of you have seen, which reports that Americans want, quote, off the world stage. The poll says that 42% of the American public believe the U.S. should mind its own business internationally, up from 30% who felt that way in 2002, and comparable to the mid-70s after Vietnam. Also, influential Americans feel spreading democracy is a great idea, but they doubt it will work. And of course, they all view the rise of China as a potential problem. On the world stage, I need not move through an unhappy list of reversals, problems at the UN Security Council, unable to get support to impose sanctions on Iran for its nuclear program. That's something of great importance to Washington, and it hasn't come about. The president has had a difficult trip to Buenos Aires, met demonstrations in Korea, and U.S. is now, it turns out, less popular than Chinese or Germans or even the UK, according to the Pew polls. And positive, negative ratings for the US and the Middle East are not very high. Finally, the United States faces a wrenching dilemma in Iraq. To withdraw, as many now feel Washington should, leaves the impression internationally that the U.S. is a fickle ally. Washington would gain the reputation of an uncertain trumpet, unsure of itself, the applicability of its values, and unwilling to follow through on commitments. Not to withdraw its troops in the next 12 months risks leaving the administration isolated domestically, or a majority want to exit Iraq, and isolated internationally, where the Italians, the British, and others are planning to reduce and then eliminate their troop commitments to Iraq. This is not, if I may say, a promising recipe for empire. Has the neocon moment passed? Yes and no. We may not hear the phrase neoconservative used much going forward. Richard Pearl told me last week that the phrase was meaningless, and that had his prescriptions for Iraq been followed, the outcome would have been very different. What we will see with the next crisis, the next time America feels itself challenged, perhaps by China, is the nation's sense of exceptionalism again rising to the surface. What one hopes is that the lessons learned in the run-up to this war, the institutional failures we experienced, can be avoided next time, that the rational center will not be cowed by adrenaline-powered patriotism, that the debate will be welcomed, not suppressed, by the political leadership, and that the resulting policy will be focused, distilled, and designed to achieve rational objectives. So while the neocons have blunted their sword and likely broken it, their muse survives and must be tamed. I thank you.
Thanks very much. I'd now like to introduce Professor Ann Norton.
Well, I'm too short for this microphone. American conservatism once had a clear commitment to certain very simple tenets. All right, but then you won't be able to see me, will you? What?
The other mic.
Sorry, I'm not very good with technology. American conservatism once had a clear commitment to certain simple tenets. Conservatives reverence custom and tradition. They believe that with wealth and power came responsibility. They resisted change. They distrusted abstract principles. They had a kind of high-minded regard for education and the arts. They wanted to preserve things. And they advocated a small government. This disposition, this is not my disposition, but it is an honorable one, and it has a long and respected history both in England and the United States. Neoconservatives radically depart from that disposition. They are not preservers. They are, as Tom DeLay once told me, revolutionaries. Neoconservatives want a strong state. They want a state that will put its strength to use. They want a state that will ally itself with and empower corporations. I mean, here one sees very strongly the fine Italian hand of Dick Cheney. They want an economic rhetoric that speaks to the concerns of small business and small property owners, working people. But they want to see the benefits given to the wealthiest individuals and to corporations. They reject the vulgarity of mass culture. They deplore the decadence of artists and intellectuals. Although they are often not particularly religious themselves, they ally themselves with religion and with religious crusades. They encourage family values. For women, this means a return to children, cooking, and the church. They want a strong state and a strong leader. They speak favorably of authoritarian leaders abroad, particularly Pervez Musharraf and Lee Kuan Yew of Singapore. They favor the expansion of executive power at home, and they argue that America would profit from a more authoritarian presidency, as they say, a more disciplined democracy. They believe in facing up, as they say, to the necessity for moderate physical pressure, or what we used to call torture. They hold their highest criticism for nations that hold too strictly to their constitutions, and they recommend a greater degree of surveillance over the universities, particularly what Carrie Lord calls lunatic and sinister professors. They have a foreign policy that makes a romance of war. They have a fear of world government and international institutions. They pride themselves, as they say, on their ability to distinguish friends from enemies. Neoconservatives like Irving Kristol credit that to Thucydides. But Thucydides, of course, for Thucydides, would have friends and enemies would have been what? The allies of Darius? This is Carl Schmitt, not Thucydides. Irving Kristol argues that Europeans are skeptical of American neoconservatism because it's a very American thing. It's bound up with that cheerful and robust character that belongs to Americans. But I think Europeans distrust neoconservatism because they know its progenitors too well. The shadows of both German National Socialism and 19th century empire fall very heavily on the neoconservative project. A few months ago, I was in the parking lot of a grocery store outside Philadelphia in a very conservative, quiet area called the Main Line. And I saw a woman putting her groceries and her child into a nice little station wagon. And in the back of the station wagon, she had made her own bumper sticker and taped it up in the window. And the bumper sticker said, "Is it fascism yet?" Not yet, probably. But we know we have secret prisons now. We also have a new model army, and we have postmodern pogroms. The project for a new American century, the vanguard of the Straussian neoconservatives, sees the world as the present of the world of the present as one of American hegemony, and for them that represents an opportunity that's not to be missed. Indeed, they redefine national security in an understanding that the Bush administration took up very enthusiastically, not as defending against a threat, but as seizing an opportunity. In fact, Bill Kristol characterizes this as the opportunity to, in his words, make trouble in the world. The object of making trouble is to establish a new world order to rival Rome. Wolfowitz likes to call this the Pax Americana. And Rumsfeld's army, the legions of the Pax Americana, forward this in a very old and recognizable way. The new legions are a light and mobile force, professional, but also poor. Its officer corps is volunteer, technocratic, and well-trained. But the enlisted people and the reservists who make up the ranks are largely drawn from the ranks of the poor and often the disenfranchised. Indeed, it is one of the quickest roads to citizenship, often posthumous citizenship. It's also supplemented by what we call civilian contractors. These used to be called mercenaries. They have a strategy that I believe is very familiar and very disturbing. In the 19th century, pogroms were assaults on another neighborhood. In the 21st, pogroms are conducted on a global scale. 19th century pogroms were raids, sometimes orchestrated, sometimes simply the unleashing of an ungovernable violence. They began with lies about crimes, lies about terrorist acts, lies about barbarity. The target, however, was already guilty, and it didn't matter. There was little shame if the initial charges were disproven. There were flying raids on a house, a quarter, a neighboring town, and there were flashes of violence intended to shock and awe not only those attacked, but other Jews in other towns. Fear was to make them more quiet, more docile, more acquiescent. American actions are all too close to these. The invasion of Iraq began with a lightning campaign intended to shock and awe not only the Iraqis, but the Arab world, and indeed the entire Dar al-Islam. The invasion was justified by allegations of weapons of mass destruction, links between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. It didn't matter that the allegations were disproven because the target was already guilty. Saddam Hussein, in the words of George Bush, was an evildoer, and he deserved punishment. In Afghanistan, the invasion was justified by the pursuit of Osama bin Laden. He's still out there. It's kind of like finding Waldo in the children's book. That it was also justified by the Taliban's crimes against women, crimes that were ostensibly characteristic of Arabs and Islam, and like a modern pogrom, it had a swift and violent entry that was short in duration and devastating in its effects. Civilian casualties have been heavy, but the silence concerning them is heavier still. In neither case has there been much attempt at nation building, and there was to be no attempt at imperial administration. The troops were to remain in the neoconservative model only for a very short time. American troops were to strike and leave. Would this have been an honorable course? Is this America's absolution from the sin of imperial ambition? Or is this simply the pogrom in a postmodern form? And why, we might ask, does it strike where it does? It strikes where it does for the most tragic of all reasons, because the American empire has Israel at its heart. The alliance of America and Israel is held to by nearly all Americans. And it's held to by me. It was supposed to be the way that America proved itself superior to a genocidal Europe. Europe killed Jews, America makes them at home, and defends their homeland. And it developed in an America that was deeply conflicted about racial and ethnic equality. If America defended Israel, then perhaps we could forget our own history of slavery, anti-Semitism, dispossession. Perhaps we could forget racial inequality in the present. In supporting Israel, America was to show its commitment to a democracy that was very different from our own. And it was to show its commitment to religious freedom for religions that were not our own. It was thus going to be proof that America was not as the nations, that the New World had surpassed the old. It was very much an ideology of American exceptionalism. But for some Americans, America is joined to Israel not as allied democracies, but as one chosen people to another. In his first term, George Bush incautiously but accurately referred to the global war on terror as a crusade. And that clarified the site and the boundaries of this providential struggle. It was going to take place in the Holy Land. It's been fought most zealously by commanders like General William Boykin, who famously and phallically boasted of his confrontation with a Somali Muslim. "I knew my God was bigger than his." You know, you have to pause before a statement like that. It's so dense with political and theological error. But you have to remember, General Boykin is still in the American military. At the end of the 19th century, it was the Jewish anarchist and the Jewish communist who were portrayed as agents of global terror. Now it is Muslims who are involved in shadowy global conspiracies, Muslims who have fellow travelers, Muslims who cannot be trusted. The old language of anti-Semitism has found another target in America. We have licensed anti-Semitism at home and funded it abroad on the condition that it take the Arab rather than the Jew as its target. We have made it a providential calling to extend freedom. We have made this the engine of empire, and we have constructed a providential enemy to justify wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, war crimes in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. Yehuda Amichai writes that everything in the Middle East comes in three languages, Hebrew, Arabic, and death. But now, death speaks English with an American accent. Thank you.
Very good. Can I throw the meeting open for comments, questions? And, of course, the speakers will have a chance to comment on each other's work as well, but let's go to the audience. Yeah. No, lady behind you. Yeah, you're
It seemed to be I'm not quite sure whether I heard your last words, Professor Dr. Halper, correctly. You said that the neocons should be tamed. I think those were your last words, weren't they?
Does this work?
Perhaps.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Anyone? Yeah. No, I was.
Could I just go on and?
That's not what I said.
It isn't. Oh, yeah. Right. Well, that's what I heard.
You did say that.
Well,
though.
What?
That's why I'm trying to get to.
Okay. All right. Well, I think most people in this room would think that they should be tamed anyway. And one way to tame them would be to expose the real facts about 9/11, which, as probably most people know, and certainly this audience will know, was an inside job. And the towers were brought down by demolition. And so how would this impact on the situation?
Can I just say, please, that what I did say is that the neocons have blunted their sword, likely broken it, and their muse, meaning American exceptionalism, survives and must be tamed. As to your point, I reject it completely.
Yeah, can we get one into the middle there?
In response to something to Professor Norton's speech, you sort of mentioned this sort of language of fascism with the neocons, and it reminds me of a concept that Sheldon Wolin recently sort of has used to describe a new political form in America of inverted totalitarianism. And I just wonder whether you think that this is either sort of overblown rhetoric or is something that rings true, and it seems to ring close to what you're saying and what that therefore means.
Sorry, I could never manage these things. I've talked about this actually with Sheldon Rowland, and he also has that construction in the new edition of Politics and Vision about superpower, and I agree. I think that oddly enough, what the neoconservatives recognize the arguments about the diffusion of empire that people like Foucault and Hart and Negri make, they recognize that in practice much more effectively than anyone else in America does. And they've succeeded in producing a kind of disseminated monitoring that is, I think, a kind of inverted totalitarianism. Really, one of the most interesting sort of symptoms of this and the culture of surveillance that it breeds is one aspect of that, what do you call it, that RMA thing?
Oh, Revolution in Military Affairs.
Yes, and this thing called Objective Force Warrior that Rumsfeld is very enthusiastic about. It involves soldiers wearing little T-shirts that monitor their vital signs constantly, but that also let the governing authority know where they are at any time. The argument that they make is that it makes each soldier an army of one, as the slogan has it. But of course, it binds them all in a network of surveillance. So, and I think this is simply one detail, one moment in this what should we call it? In what Wolin calls superpower and a new form of domination.
I just would like to comment on my esteemed colleague's view of the revolution in military affairs. It may possibly be a way of keeping track of all of the soldiers on a field. And it may also be, as I said, an inappropriate set of technologies for the kinds of wars that we're fighting at the moment. But that doesn't mean it's an inappropriate set of technologies for the kinds of wars we may confront in the future. And there could very well be large set battles with a large, technically competent adversary that require highly proficient individual units to be able to operate with maximum information available to each one of them in very difficult battle space conditions. So I don't reject this revolution in military affairs, really. Sorry?
Sorry.
Sorry. Yeah.
Allow me a few minutes to formulate.
Preferably not a few minutes.
How
about a question?
Well, it is, it's not a question, it's a comment. If you would like to consider
the
microphone. Yeah. Well, the association of the association of the new conservatism to the origins of the American Empire, I found from both speakers that it's a bit excessive. Surely the origins of the American Empire preceded the new conservatism, and it has been, since the disintegration of the Soviet Union, it has been a concerted effort to undermine the authority of the United Nations for the purpose of replacing it with some kind of new world order. Now, in this respect, the bombing of Yugoslavia, for example, or the policing of the non-fly zone after the first Iraq war were indications whereby the authority of the United Nations was usurped in order to create this idea of the new world order. In this respect, the adventure of Iraq is the continuation of this tendency, and the difference is that it is one adventure which went too badly, and which, of course, released the tendency to find scapegoats. From my point of view, there is no difference between the invasion, the bombing of Yugoslavia, the invasion of Iraq, the invasion of Afghanistan, because the evidence on which the invasion of Afghanistan was based is not confirmed, is not more real than the weapons of mass destruction. No one has proven that Bin Laden was in Afghanistan. No one has proven beyond doubt that Bin Laden was responsible for the September 11th.
Cleansing
in
Yugoslavia. No one proved that.
Okay, thanks. I think that was a comment of some kind rather than a question. Over there. Yeah.
Hi. I think that something that puzzles a lot of observers is that the neocons, as we, you know, difficult group to define, but are undeniably a very intelligent group of people. And I think what is puzzling, perhaps particularly from a sort of European perspective, perhaps, is an apparent failure to comprehend blowback, as discussed by, you know, obviously Chalmers Johnson and so on. And it's puzzling, and there are various reasons offered for that, that it is in fact a hidden rationale that there are, or simply ignorance or whatever. But I wonder if you'd comment on what is so hard to comprehend, apparently, about the idea that blowback is going to happen, that this is a very unpopular set of policies, and it's going to worsen the situation rather than improve it.
Well, it's an interesting question. Certainly they are very intelligent, extraordinarily capable people. Richard Perrault, Wolfowitz, the rest of them worked effectively in the 1980s against the Soviet Union and were instrumental in the success that I think the West had. There is no taking that away from them. What you'd probably have to say is that with the demise of the Soviet Union and effectively the end of the Cold War and their shift of attention to the Near East, the first effort, which they really had their hands on, I'm sure someone will prove me wrong on this, but it seems to me the first effort they really formulated probably came after 9/11. I'm not suggesting that PNAC is the Project for a New American Century and other neocon manifestations weren't there. They certainly were. But bringing the nation into war probably in their own administration probably came in. Now, Perrault will admit in a very forthright way that this has not gone the way they expected. They did not expect these kind of reversals. They haven't had this sort of experience with this kind of blowback. You could say that the neoconservatives did support U.S. operations in the former Yugoslavia. But it was a different administration. They didn't formulate the effort. They were simply in it as an expression of American values and concern for someone mentioned the genocide, which was underway and has obviously since been proven.
Sorry. Can I make a number of comments, please? I'm rather out of sympathy with the two lectures that we heard. I don't recognize an American empire because if you have free elections and draw up constitutions and give rights to women, that doesn't seem to me like imperialism. It seems to me slightly more like democracy, which is what they say they're trying to do. Nor do I regard it as an exceptional American trend to project your own form of constitution abroad. This is what the British, after all, did all over the world in trying to establish parliamentary democracy in Asia and Africa. It's what the French did in their Mission Civilisatrice and their assimilation policies. It's quite normal. Even the post-war Germany wants to make the whole of Europe into a federal republic, just in the way Germany was. So projecting your own types of government onto others isn't exceptional. It's quite commonplace. Thirdly, it seems to me that trying to interpret America as a Fourth Reich is slightly over the top, to say the least. And it's also rather strange to talk merely in terms of ideology, because after all, the roots of American policy stem, as a gentleman tried to say, from the 1990s, when again America went to war without a UN resolution over Yugoslavia. But all that wasn't because of neoconservatism. It was obviously because the European Union in its own diplomacy had failed. America had to be dragged in because Europe couldn't work. And it was these rather more prosaic origins of American foreign policy that bolstered a new initiative to use force if problems became very difficult that I think might be seen as a proper background rather than just pure ideology as such. So don't you think in the light of, I would have thought, these rather straightforward and obvious criticisms of what you've put forward, you might like to modify your theses?
Are you both over-egging the pudding, I think, is the question, isn't it?
Well, I jump horses for fun, and so I believe in going over the top. First of all, the free elections. I think that the sort of what we see, the sanctifications of the Iraqi elections is really fairly shocking. I mean, these were elections that at their best were conducted under conditions of occupation, under radical insecurity, and under the gun. Secondly, you might be interested to look at the CIA's website. The CIA has a little nice little website that has all facts about countries, it says. And it gives the country and its type of government. So it says, Iran, type of government, Islamic theocracy. Iraq, type of government, none. That, I think, is a very telling account of what the United States is actually the case on the ground in Iraq. Secondly, what the U.S. has done in Iraq is not simply sort of put in a more democratic government, but rather split a state into ethnic divisions, disenfranchise the secular, radically worsened conditions for women, and in short, produced exactly the result that we say we're trying to stand against. So I think rather than, I don't know about over-egging the pudding, but I think we could use a few more dates and nuts in it too.
I must say that I'm sympathetic with the question and the way in which it was put. I think that in many respects, the United States has been a remarkable force for good internationally. And as a long-term conservative myself, over 30 years or 35 years in various Republican governments, I think that we've done our best, for the most part, in working with the United Nations, in supporting the World Bank, in providing stability in East Asia, authoring the Marshall Plan, a variety of other things. And I'm rather proud of what the United States has done over many, many years. But I take exception to what the neoconservatives have done. because these are not traditional conservatives. These are radicals who have embraced adventure and risk and profligate spending in ways that are demonstrably unproductive. And the price is being paid by the American taxpayer and by American credibility worldwide, just in the kinds of circumstances that we find ourselves this evening. So it is a very sad moment that these folks managed to achieve the policy positions and the kind of power of the discourse which they did. I don't see the United States as projecting a fourth Reich, and it isn't attempting, or hasn't generally, to project its government on others. My point on American exceptionalism is that it arises from a kind of clarity of moral purpose and an anointment of direction. There's a kind of religious quality to it, which rises rapidly when the nation is in crisis or feels itself threatened. And it's a dangerous phenomenon. It's something we just need to watch. Thanks.
Done there, thanks.
Thank you very much. My name is Eugene Kogan. I'm a master's student in international relations here. Could I bring you back to the title of the talk, and which is quite strategic, and ask you sort of a long-term question? And this was prompted by Dr. Halper mentioning that the United States has been a remarkable force for good, something that I personally have been waiting for to hear. You both in your talk sounded unmistakably pessimistic about the state of the United States abroad and at home, particularly troubling, since this was something that I've done some research on. Was Dr. Halper's mentioning that the serious failure of the Congress to ask hard questions, actually not just about Iraq, but since 9/11 until the present day. So my question is, are you suggesting, are both of you suggesting, or either one of you suggesting, that what we're seeing is that we are approaching, to quote the title of a pretty well-known book, the end of American era? And if that is so, how does this bode for the world? Thanks so much.
Who would you like to speak?
Either of you.
I'll try to answer that very quickly. First of all, I believe that the Congress was derelict in not raising the tough questions until very recently. It took an out-of-work governor from a tiny state on the periphery of the Democratic primary process in the presidential election 2004 to put the Iraq question on the table. And it wasn't until he generated support for a critical view of this that other politicians followed in and began to debate this issue in Congress. So that's the first point. I think that in terms of pessimism, I'm not pessimistic. I am concerned that institutions function as we expect them to do, and put tension in the dialogue in the midst of crises, as crises emerge, so that we can move towards better policy. It's not the end of the American era. What it is a challenge to do this policy function a bit better.
So. Yeah. Thanks so much.
Speaker, can we have, I think everybody in the audience wants to ask a question. So
you can take the next one.
Yes. I personally wonder whether America is spreading democracy or corporatocracy, because one thing that is missing in both presentations is the link between the neoconservatists and their love for oil all over the world. And if really America is spreading democracy. We saw the situation in Iran, Mossadegh overthrown, the Shah brought in Panama, in Congo, the young democracy represented by the only elected leader, Patrice Lumumba, killed. All over the world, we have example of America itself killing democracy while at the same time pretending to be spreading democracy. Now, when we talk about the spreading democracy in Iraq and many other places, and we say that the power of neoconservatives is diminishing, it's not that they are pulling out and leaving major American corporations benefiting out of it, whether with the minerals in Congo or oil in Iraq or all over the place. So the question is America spreading democracy or corporatocracy all over the world? And John Perkins, whom you may know, has just written a book about the confession of economic hitmen, like Professor Ann talked about civilian contractor, those mercenaries who go all around the world, hit first. If they can't get a leader to agree with American interests, then the military will come in and he will be either overthrown or there will be war on his hand.
I'll respond to it. I think that looking at the construction of the American empire as being something that's done simply in the service of corporations is inadequate. I think it's inadequate because it misses something. It misses the things that are necessary to bring ordinary people into the process, which must happen. Some of those are American exceptionalism, certain kinds of evangelical fervor, certain intellectual rationales that the Straussians provide. But there is an interesting dimension to corporate power that I think is quite important. And that is, I don't know if you've read Achille Mbembe's work on private indirect government. That, I think, is quite interesting, that increasingly the United States is like many governments all over the world, but Mbembe talks particularly about Africa, is handing over the once prized attributes of sovereignty, like control over violence, to private contractors, as they call them, civilian contractors, which is to say they're handing it over to corporations who then govern indirectly. That's a fascinating and important development, I think, and it seems to me to be much more important to see the way in which corporations are now sort of hiving off some of the functions of sovereignty than to see government as simply in the service of corporations.
Yeah. Hi, my remark is for Professor Norton. It is very striking for me to hear your point, and especially your comparison between neoconservatism and fascism. And I think even that it's quite dangerous, as I think attacking Saddam Hussein is not the same thing as attacking the Jews. And settling democracy in the Middle East, however difficult it may be and however optimistic it may be, it's different from attacking the Jews for ethnic reasons. And I would like to know if you could a bit develop your point and if I didn't misunderstand what you were saying. And but I was a bit worried when you also answered that, for instance, the election in Iraq was a scam because I didn't see any Iraqi people getting to the voting with the gun on their head. So I don't really understand why you're saying this, and I think it's dangerous because it leads us to defend neoconservatism and defend maybe what should be something to criticize, but not to attack like that.
This is, I think, the most controversial thing I say in America, and it is. I say it because I believe it to be the most important. I think that anti-Semitism directed at Arabs, by which I mean the old, very familiar formula of anti-Semitism, is pervasive in American culture,
and that it is guiding American policy. And in, you know, in works that I've written more extensively, I've tried to lay that out. I mean, if you read, one of the best places to look for it is to see Richard Perle's book, Richard Perle and David Frum's book, An End to Evil, where they tell you, they say, other people are too timid to tell you, but we'll tell you the enemy is Islam. And they go on to say that it's not just radical Muslims or Islamo-fascists, as neoconservatives like to talk about. It's, as they say, it's your neighbor. And I saw this among the among the Straussians when I was growing up, when I was in college, when I was in graduate school, and it troubled me very much then. Now I see these men in positions of power guiding American policy, and it troubles me greatly. Moreover, I've had to walk out of my house and scrub off of trucks and walls anti-Arab, anti-Muslim slogans. These are things which I think Americans don't like to recognize, and that's why I feel it necessary to speak about them. I think it is a danger guiding American policy, and I think it is extraordinarily important. I think it's much easier to recognize wrongs that happened in the past because they are past and we don't have to bear any guilt for them. But I think that this is a wrong which is happening now in my country and in my school, on my street. And so it's that wrong that I have to speak against most loudly.
Stefan.
I just want to say I appreciate this commitment on your part to take that position. But I really don't believe that Perle and Frum, in this extraordinary little screed that they wrote, represents a coherent view, either of the neoconservative position or a sufficient critique, a serious critique, of the American political process. This is a bizarre little book, which got visibility mainly because of the people who wrote it. They wrote it very quickly. It's got no footnotes. It's very poorly constructed, so on and so forth. It just strikes me as not an adequate point to use in this kind of argument. On the question of anti-Semitism, what you've got in America, it seems to me, is the same concern about the other that you have expressed in Britain, where you have demonstrable anti-Islamic graffiti. The same thing in France. We've seen it here. In Germany, we've had it for a long time. The Russians have got it all over Moscow. What does it mean? Well, it means simply that people feel threatened, and they can identify the people they think they're threatened by, and they're trying to separate themselves from the dynamics of that threat by graffiti or whatever other ways they've got. This is not an indictment of the United States. It is simply that people are very sensitive about the other. It's an age-old issue. We've got to work our way through it. We have a body of laws that negotiate these questions, as the Brits do, as other countries do. So I just don't take this. I think that's just going a little too far.
Okay, thanks. Up the top there. Yeah.
Does this work?
Yeah.
I think the point about neoconservatism.
Yeah.
I think the point about neoconservatism is that it has been really, really successful for the U.S. Obviously, the allies and the targets of U.S. neoconservatives have not benefited that much. But I think neoconservatism has worked for the U.S. overall. And exceptionalism, for example, led to containment and the Truman Doctrine and the New Frontier and the Reagan Doctrine. And all of this led the U.S. to win the Cold War because it was able to outmaneuver the Soviet Union. And moreover, in fact, Reagan and his neoconservative policies will be remembered for winning the Cold War. And I don't think he'll be remembered for attacking Grenada, Libya, Guatemala, El Salvador, etc. And so would you agree that neoconservatism has, in fact, led the U.S. to become a superpower?
Which of you?
No, I don't. I'll leave Stefan a little time. I don't think so, because first of all, America was a superpower well before Reagan. I mean, you're quite young, but America was a military superpower when I was young, and that was not so recently. So I don't think one can quite credit the neoconservatives with that. In some ways, I suppose, if you wanted to credit Reagan, you'd have to credit an older kind of conservatism and not the new one. I will leave Stefan some time.
Well, I thank you for providing me that little platform, because Ronald Reagan was anything but a neoconservative. He was not an adventurous man. He was very sensitive to the budget. He wanted smaller government. He was very calculating in the commitments that he made. The distinction is that this group of neoconservatives are radical. Their budgetary expenditures are very large, stunningly large, and the prospects of achieving their objectives are much less. The point about the United States being a superpower long before the neoconservatives actually came along is absolutely correct. Achievements as a result of containment, which authored by Kennan, these are achievements which are not in any way attributable to neoconservatives. So I think that I would have to disagree.
I'm going to take three questions together now. I've got...
Can I have some of your water?
Don't get François Xavier, who's been waving his arm, and then Ben.
Thank you. Just a quick question. You both have mentioned state building, or what Americans generally call over here. What many Americans call nation building, including many of the scholars. If you could just maybe make some comment about the prospects for state building in U.S. foreign policy in the future as related to either neoconservatism or American exceptionalism.
Okay, thanks. State building.
Hi. My question is for Professor Norton. I did my dissertation last year on Leo Strauss' influence on Bush foreign policy. And I mean, my conclusion, like, disagree with your point in your book. And I would like to hear from you. Because I think that for Leo Strauss, Leo Strauss praised unilateralism in foreign policy. But, I mean, for him, prudence and moderation were also the core concept of his thought. And secondly, he promoted the moral superiority of democracy over totalitarianism and above communism. But he also was very aware of the weakness of democracy, and he was also very critical of democracy, so contrary to the neocon. And lastly, he was really against crusade abroad, and he was preaching for a realist foreign policy and not for a revolutionary foreign policy, as the neocons do now. So I think that in your book, you tend to conflate Leo Strauss and the Straussians, and I think that the Straussians, or those who are named Straussians, have, in fact, perverted or deviated Leo Strauss' ideas for their own thought. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Ben.
I think many of the questions from the audience tonight, and also the fact that we have here a self-confessed Republican and I assume someone of the more liberal persuasion, both writing books criticising the neoconservatives, demonstrate that neoconservatism actually plays a very simple but very important function in American politics, which is that it's a scapegoat. It enables, if you don't mind me saying, a Democratic Party and increasingly the realist wing of the Republican Party, who all overwhelmingly voted for a war, to retrospectively disassociate themselves from it. But of course, in doing so, and in the Europeans doing the same thing, and by heaping and suggesting that somehow we're all tricked into it by this very small group of hyper-intelligent, Machiavellian, basically Jewish, this cabal of people who are sort of controlled from Israel, by suggesting that this is really what it's all about. The term neoconservatives, which clearly is an important term and clearly an important force in American politics, the term becomes stripped of all meaning and uses any kind of explanatory power. So, for example, the most obvious example of this is referring to Rumsfeld and Cheney, who in Europe are always called the arch neocons. Rumsfeld and Cheney aren't really neoconservatives. They're, if anything, they're assertive nationalists or traditional conservatives. So my point is simply that by lumping, by kind of making these arch caricature, doesn't the term neoconservative become a useless one when, in fact, when used with more kind of discretion and moderation, it could be still useful?
Okay, there's a good agenda there. Both of you.
If I may respond to the last question, you're absolutely right that if you create a caricature and then attempt to criticize it, it's not a very useful exercise. But I don't believe that what I've described as neoconservatives really constitutes a caricature. I've argued continuously that neither Cheney nor Rumsfeld are neoconservatives. I agree not only with you, but with your phrase. They are nationalists. And as far as a cabal is concerned, controlled from Israel, that's perfectly ridiculous. It is not anything like that. There are any number of neoconservatives who are not Jewish, and Jean Kirkpatrick, Daniel, Patrick Moynihan, Bell, all the rest. So I think that it's, in a sense, we don't want to, as it were, dispose of this category under false pretenses. It's not a foil that permits liberals and Republicans to sort of walk away from the war. There are real reasons why both parties in Congress feel that they were misled, and those are that the administration had access to highly specific intelligence briefed every morning by CIA and the NSA and the FBI, which was not available to the Congress. So when people assert that, oh, well, we all had the same intelligence, how come you guys all of a sudden are rewriting history, as Mr. Cheney did yesterday, this is a canard. I mean, it is simply untrue. So I would just make those points. On the point of state building, which is a very good question, the United States really is not involved in bilateral, at least in my understanding, bilateral state building. It is supporting various kinds of national development through World Bank, UN, multilateral fora. And of course it has a very powerful AID program and that sort of thing. So in a sense, many of the instruments for economic and civic development are there. But as far as nation building per se, this is a very subtle technology, and it's not something that, where there's an office in Washington when people are able to do it. I don't know that there's any office anywhere which is able to do it. So I'll just leave it at that.
Okay.
Let me take the Strauss question first. Clearly I was not clear enough in my book, because I thought I had made it crystal clear that I don't think Strauss and Straussians are in any way the same. In fact, one of the sort of rather shocking things, it seems to me, is the way in which the Straussians do depart from Strauss, certainly in things like prudence, but also, I think, quite strikingly, in Strauss's approach to the Middle East. I mean, Strauss was the person who brought Al-Farabi back to the American Academy. And Strauss's understanding of the importance of the State of Israel, that is an extraordinarily moving part of his work. So one of the things I thought I had argued strongest for in my book was that Strauss ought not to be held responsible for the sins of his so-called followers. However, on the question of holding people responsible, of scapegoating, that's a very well-crafted question. And I don't think that the neoconservatives are a cabal, much less a Jewish cabal, nor do I think they operate from Israel. I think they have a very interesting strategic location in American politics. The Straussian conservatives, neoconservatives, made it possible to reconcile previously conservative forces that were previously not allied. One of these were Christian evangelicals. Another set were the neoconservatives themselves. One was the, which we call the party of the corporations, as it were, business interests in the United States. And it managed to offer a program that appealed not only to those traditionally Republican sectors, but also, and here I agree with you completely, the Democrats have a lot to answer for. It appealed to Democrats, and it appealed particularly to a liberal position called humanitarian interventionism. And that, I think, has deep roots in American political culture, that and roots that, that indeed go well beyond America and into the Enlightenment. It's the argument is, because we have reason, we know your interests. Because we are all human, we know not only what you need, but what you want. And so we don't need your consent to give it to you. And in fact, the less you want it, the more we can tell, since anyone should want this, that you must be either deluded or oppressed. And so the more you resist us, the more we have a moral obligation to overcome that. And that ideology, which you see in people like Edward Lilienfeld, Martha Nussbaum, Michael Ignatieff, that has a lot of appeal for Democrats. And I think it has been, it was the ability of the neocons to offer something that drew those people in that did much of the damage.
Okay, thanks. We're running very close out of time. Time for maybe a couple of questions, and I think we'd better take them from the top since they've been neglected recently. That gent there, yep.
Can you hear me? I just wanted to ask both of you whether you think that no matter how it's turned out in practice, the neoconservative idea that bringing democracy to the Middle East is a good way to tackle the roots of Islamic terrorism is correct in theory.
Nice crisp question, I like that.
Thanks.
Hi, this is mainly directed to the second speaker and how it seems an arbitrary comment how you can say that America's war in Iraq is connected to a pogrom. For surely there's more evidence than just to say, oh yeah, they're Muslims, so let's invade Iraq and Afghanistan. Surely 9/11 had a lot to do with it. And if you could explain your answer more, and I'd like to hear Dr. Stefan's view as well, if that's possible.
Thanks. That's last question, chap at the top there. Yes, you, sir.
Professor Halper, maybe you could go into some questions about to the extent that the U.S. Has been frustrated by the U.N. as a mechanism for conflict resolution, particularly since you had a lot of outstanding resolutions on Saddam Hussein, and that subsequently we found that either out of principle or out of subordination or successful manipulation by Iraq, one can argue that the UN has been singularly ineffective in dealing with some of these issues on its previous resolutions. And Professor Norton, isn't your formulation just another opportunistic recitation of the attempts to translate and reverse Nazi imagery onto Israel, which has been going on since the 1960s?
Let's take those.
Right, we've now the last. This is the last round of questions, so I think we'll give the two speakers a chance to respond to those, but also to say anything else they've got on there that they'd like to get out of their systems before we thank them for the evening. Who wants to go first? Stefan, do you want to go first?
Yeah, that's fine. I don't have anything to get out of my system, so I'm fine with that.
Actually, I do. So.
This question raised about whether democracy being brought to the Middle East was a way of attacking the roots of terrorism. Was that the question? Yeah. I obviously there are two schools on this, and I think there's a pretty good argument for saying that attempting to provide democracy to the Middle East, which is at this point at least a top-down process. Effectively, there are some elections, local elections underway in Saudi, and there have been a couple of rounds in Egypt, but they're I'm not sure you describe them as a pluralist democratic process. I'm not sure that this has done much at all to address the problem of terrorism. There's a powerful argument made by some of the military commanders in the region that the problem of terrorism has been exacerbated by the changes in the political structure that we've attempted to provide. And I say we, I mean the coalition. The traditional structures, the tribal structures, are such that they're having great difficulty accommodating to the kind of formats that we're looking for in these coming elections. And so I think probably the terrorism situation has not been enormously improved, which is a tragedy because obviously one wanted that to happen. But does that answer your question? Okay. On the issue of the United Nations, look, there's no question that with 12 or 13 resolutions on the table and an inability to deal with Saddam's Iraq or have him comply, that the United Nations left the appearance and probably the fact of being ineffectual. But I'm very drawn by another perspective on this, which is that there was a northern fly zone and a southern fly zone. The UN had inspectors in Iraq on the ground, and they turned up an enormous amount of information of both Blix and Baraday. There were overhead intelligence capabilities which both the US and UK deployed, and we had intelligence assets on the ground. Now, it wasn't a perfect process, and Saddam was able to move around the edges of it in the oil for food program. And obviously, there was enormous corruption, and the UN itself was found to be at fault in much of it. But if you stand back and you ask yourself how much it cost for us to administer that set of restraints, and how many men were lost, how many kids were wounded. We've got 15,800 in Walter Reed and other hospitals with no arms and legs and so on. You'd have to conclude that while it was a highly imperfect process and very frustrating and revealed all of the weaknesses of the United Nations, that generally speaking, we were muddling along, and we might have found a way of dealing with Saddam Hussein other than this full-out confrontation. So I guess that's, if I can suggest, there's several ways of looking at it, that would be one that I'd offer to you.
Sure. Let me respond first to the charge that I'm trying to transfer Nazi imagery to Israel. I didn't say thing one about Israel. I'm talking about the United States. And in fact, I don't say anything about Israel because I don't think it would be true about Israel. It is an American. What I'm interested in, because I am an American and bear responsibility for my own country, is the rise of anti-Semitic language directed against Arabs. And I'm concerned about this for two reasons. One, it's wrong. And two, it is behind the wars of my time. And consequently, I think that it is not a useful distraction to talk about this as if it were a kind of a revival of an old charge against Israel. It is a relatively new charge against the United States. With regard to bringing democracy to the Middle East, I'm quite old-fashioned in this regard. I don't think democracy is built by arms. I think democracy rests upon the consent of the governed. And so I don't think it is readily installed by military force. I think the adventure in Iraq proves that in a very sharp and disturbing way. We have less democracy in the Middle East, and we have more terror. This is not a good result.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Before I thank our speakers, can I give, on behalf of the Cold War Studies Centre, an advert for next week's talk? Professor Gordon Wood from Brown University will be speaking on the origins of American constitutionalism. This is the inaugural lecture in the Gilda Lehman Lecture Series in American History, and it promises to be a very important and interesting evening. Having given the commercial break, I'd now like to thank our two speakers for and the audience, I think, for a really interesting exchange of views. I can't tell you how frustrated I've been sitting there not being able to join in, but some of my students will probably guess the answer to that one. But I'd like to extend the thanks of the audience to both our speakers for a really enjoyable evening.